This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You look at the rise of some of these, you look at the capture of power in the right wing, the ascent of white nationalism, the concentration of wealth, and as a consequence, political power. And you cannot really animate or concentrate a movement like that without a sense of persecution or victimhood. And that is what the role of cancel culture is.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is one of the most influential progressives in electoral politics today. And she's also a master of social media. So there's probably no better person to talk to in order to understand the position of the left on cancel culture.
It is like the speck of dust around which the raindrop must form in order to precipitate takeovers of school boards, pushing actual discourse out of the acceptable norms, like in terms of the 1619 Project, for example, getting books banned from schools. They needed and they need the concept of cancel culture to justify a political program of takeover, or really at least a further concentration of their own power. And so, you know, you talk about cancel culture, but you notice that those discussions only go one way. We don't talk about all people who were fired. You just kind of talk about like right-leaning podcast bros and like more conservative figures. But there is also something to be said about the ferocity of what an internet-fueled backlash can do that is unique, you know? And I think that that is in and of itself, I think that is a conversation, but I don't think that that is what the, you know, the cancel culture conversation is really about.
That's Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. My interview with her, which covered a lot of ground in Washington and well beyond, will be at NewYorker.com on Monday. It's part of our first digital-only issue, a special edition we're calling The New Yorker Interviews.
There used to be this conceit a few years ago, they're gonna take your guns away, they're coming to take your guns, and now it's they're gonna take your jokes away, they're gonna take your comedians, you know? And it's the same sort of element driving the narrative.
Cliff Nesteroff writes about the history of comedy.
Comedy and comedians are loved universally by right-wingers and left-wingers alike, but if you could demonize one political persuasion and say they're out to get the comedians, it's a great tactic for demonizing your opposition. I really believe there's a concerted effort on the part of think tanks and propagandists to create this illusion that the liberals are out to get the comedians and that they're the new censors.
In the debates about free speech, it's useful to consider comedy for a couple of reasons. For one thing, jokes at the expense of other people are a big point of contention here. How free do we want free speech to be when it comes to vulnerable or marginalized groups? For another, people throw around the word censorship all the time now. But in comedy, there really was a time when a joke could land you in jail. Cliff Nesteroff gives the example of Lenny Bruce in the 50s and early 60s. His persecution by the authorities is probably better remembered now than his jokes.
The things that Lenny Bruce became notorious for and eventually was hounded for and arrested for were threefold. One, he talked about organized religion on stage and would criticize organized religion.
Are you taking out of the headquarters of Religions Incorporated and seated around the desk on Madison Avenue sit the religious leaders of our country. Religion, big business. We hear H.A.
Two, he would use what you might call salty language. He swore on stage in an era in which you could literally get arrested for obscenity and put on trial and sent to jail if you swore on stage. And it was left to local vice squads to determine what was or was not obscene.
I would like an honest equation from any, at least, grammar school graduate. Is the word son of a bitch less obscene to you than motherfucker? Really? Is it the fact that...
And then the third thing that he was busted for was narcotics use. And if he toured across North America and a police department did not bust them, then the local clergy or the local civic officials would criticize the police for being derelict in their duties, even when a crime wasn't committed. So not only did Lenny Bruce get arrested for things that any of us could say today, he often got arrested simply because he was Lenny Bruce and had a reputation.
Comedians just don't face that kind of censorship in clubs these days, not to mention on Netflix specials or YouTube or podcasts and all the rest. The last bastion of government control, as Nesteroff sees it, is on network TV, where the FCC still holds sway.
When people talk about cancel culture, they never seem to reference that. That's where most of the censorship is. There's more censorship on the late-night talk shows in terms of what a stand-up comedian can and cannot say than anywhere else. And social media is not where comedy lives. That is not where stand-up exists. On the nightclub stage, at the Comedy Store, at the Comedy Cellar, at the Whitley, which is a popular club here in Los Angeles, you can say what you want, and audiences are having a great fucking time. I kind of push back on this this idea because it's just being repeated over and over on social media. But if you get off of social media, if you go to the live shows, you'll see the opposite thing happening.
That brings us to the recent controversy of Dave Chappelle and Netflix and the feeling among some people, particularly trans people, but not only, that he had transgressed in his jokes about trans people in a way that was unfair, illegitimate, even dehumanizing. And how do you look on that passage?
Think of the Chappelle show in the early 2000s and think of Dave Chappelle today. So there's a 20-year difference between Dave Chappelle emerging as this nationally or universally beloved comedian, the Chappelle show. Regardless of your political point of view, you like Dave Chappelle. Now it's 20 years later. He's still extremely successful, extremely popular, but polarizing. Bob Hope in 1949, was universally beloved. He was the top movie star in comedy, top radio star in comedy. Everybody loved Bob Hope, 1949. 20 years later, 1969, Bob Hope is still a huge star. He's still incredibly popular, but he had been speaking out in favor of the Vietnam War, against war protesters, against hippies, and in favor of President Nixon, and he became polarizing. And so I see Dave Chappelle today being rejected not just by a large contingent of transgendered people, but younger people, and supported by people that are his age or older.
I think that Dave Chappelle would probably take that as a crushing analogy. You're suggesting that Dave Chappelle is lost his juice.
I would say Dave Chappelle today, compared to Dave Chappelle 20 years ago, is square.
But
he's a square.
But on the other hand, some jokes become, in retrospect, not just bad taste, but really deeply wrong. The magazine that I work for, The New Yorker, ran cartoons in the 30s, you know, with black Africans in boiling pots surrounded by, you know, so-called white African explorers making stupid
right.
jokes. And yeah. if we ran that now, I think we'd be justifiably pilloried.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting if you look at the 1930s, of course, blackface was still prevalent and black stereotypes were prevalent. If you read the black press, which you can now do thanks to the internet, go back through the archives of newspaper.com and read the New York Age or the Pittsburgh Courier or the Chicago Defender, the Baltimore Afro-American or the California Eagle, the major black newspapers of the 1930s, you will see editorials and letters complaining about that shit all the time. Mm-hmm. Why are we being insulted? Why don't they stop with this hackneyed, tired, old stereotypes? Mm-hmm. We're beyond this. Mm-hmm. We're human beings. And nobody listened, because who was the demographic of The New Yorker in the 1930s? It was largely a white audience. So minorities and their concerns were very easily ignored in those days. I just came out with a new book recently, which is about indigenous representation or lack thereof. And I have an example in the book of a contingent of Native American leaders in the year 1911 complaining about racist stereotypes in silent movies. The year 1911. Oh, you can't joke about anything anymore. In the year 1911. So that has gone on. Those grievances have been lodged for ages, but were willfully ignored as long as indigenous peoples or African Americans did not have the purchasing power or the influence in the body politic to have their voices heard.
So what I hear you saying is, on the one hand, you are for a sense of freedom, artistic freedom, speech freedom for artists like comedians. And at the same time, an equivalent sense of support for people standing up for themselves, whether it's a group or an individual, when...
Well, standing up for yourselves is freedom of speech.
Exactly. And so you're describing it not as cancel culture, but as itself debate.
I mean, it's not even cancel culture. Yeah. It's just culture. That is culture. It's the history of America is a tug of war between opposing forces, powerful forces versus weak forces. But social media is sort of the new thing that makes everything seem new because it's in your face all day, every day. It's in your pocket. Every stoplight, you're scrolling through it. Every time you go to the bathroom, you're scrolling through it. In the old days, people would complain about certain things. They would say, oh, Milton Berle is in bad taste because he dresses up in drag. This is a bad example for my children. But you would read that letter in TV Guide once a month and never again. You didn't keep scrolling through the same TV Guide reading that same complaint over and over and over and over all day, every day. So it's just a different delivery system.
Cliff Nesteroff is a historian of comedy, and his most recent book is We Had a Little Real Estate Problem, The Unheralded Story of Native Americans and Comedy.
So do you feel like something new is going on around how outraged people seem to be getting, or do you think that's just like an all-time human problem?
I think it's like a seed that's inside of us, but we are exposed to the opinions of like millions of people at a time, and that's like a scale that we've never had to deal with.
You're not safe anywhere with TikTok and YouTube because it's viral.
You have these like out of context snippets that exist outside of you. Like this interview, I'm like, oh my God, what's going to happen?
Is it ever good for people to get outraged about things that people say or do?
Sure, you can be outraged. The thing is to control your rage. And that to me is the root word, the rage.
Thank you. On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.